accession number 28688, rule 6.
It was. What else did you ask there?
Was there any, do you think, did anybody ever approach you maybe about staying?
Oh yes, the police, yes, I was going to, I thought at one time, nobody actually approached me, but I knew that the police would have been very keen to have some of it. Although nobody ever came to me and said, would you like to stay in prison? I think that that would have been possible for me to go to the police and say, look, I would be happy to discuss a sort of term with you in Malaya. But I remember writing home to my father and saying, I thought I might do that. And he wrote back and said, that, well, it was my life, and if that's what I would like to do, I should do it. But he wasn't feeling well, and he would really be very happy if I came back. And I did come back, and he died exactly to a year to the day that I came out. I came out there in February 1954, 21st of February 54, and he died on the 21st of February 1955. So I was very pleased that I did come back.
And when you said the police there as well, was that the military police? Or
No, the Malaysian police. It would have been a civilian job. Rather, well, as far as police can be civilian, it wasn't an army job. But we would have been better after being there for a year and a half than it would have been if we'd just gone out raw, you know what I mean?
Were many men doing that, you know, changing to maybe the civilian police across there?
Well, I never knew any of my immediate friends that stayed on, but there must have been people that did stay on. Most of the plantations would have had a sort of little private police force of their own. They would have had to put the welders of care in the security guard. But a normal bungalow might have had 6 or 7 Malayan with rifles that would have been on guard at night and wandering about the camp at night. And they were never treated like the police, which the army and the police would have kind of worked a bit together. But they were treated just like servants. But they were servants that were armed, you know what I mean? And then most of them had big dogs, a lot of dogs about the place. Because it was very stealthy sort of attacks that were made on, when you would get a guy that would murder somewhere. And they might just attack one single bungalow or something like that. These people we were fighting had been fighting with us against the Japs. And in fact, I read a book called The Jungle Was Neutral about 25 years after I came home. And for the first time, I began to understand a little bit what I was supposed to be doing there. I don't know what other folks thought, but I never actually wanted what I was doing. I was just a young guy having a bit of an adventure doing what I was told, which was. And then I really figured out what I was supposed to be sort of achieving when I was there, except to get rid of these terrorists. Or stopping them killing folk you didn't want killed. It was, as I said, at least 25 years later, when I read that book, I got some inkling as to what I was supposed to be doing.
Had you not received any lectures about the political situation when you were, across in Malaya?
No. I mean, we knew that the people that we were fighting had been fighting with us at one time, and that they had been promised something which wasn't forthcoming, and they decided they would never go and get it by force. But apart from that, I never looked at the ethics of the thing, whether I should be there or not. And I think that would apply to most of them. If we were just there and we were making the best of it, as it were.
And as you got nearer the end of your service as well, did you know your date? Were you issued with a date, or was it just a case of...
Well, you vaguely knew when you were going to be coming out, yeah. And as I said, the nearer you got to that date, the more concerned you were. You didn't want to suddenly get bumped off at that stage.
And do you remember how they told you that you would be leaving?
No, I just remember we got down and got onto the boat about Singapore, and I remember the RSM in the boat was saying, welcome aboard, RAF guys, and welcome aboard to somebody else. And then there was about 12 of us gone coming, and we were in uniforms that time. And there was no welcome aboard to us. All he said was, any trouble out any of you lot, and you'll be outside fast and your feet can touch the ground. So we all looked at each other and went, a different kind of welcome for us.
And when you say you were in your uniforms, did you have your kilts out with you?
No, I was just in, you know, we were in Glengarry's on with the batch. That's why I knew we were, who we were, you see. But then when we got onto the boat, the first, well, I mean, I'm not a penis, but I do play piano a bit. And again, you got duties in the boat, like carrying beer for the hold up into the naffies upstairs. But because I played the piano, I was used to play in the evenings. I got excused carrying beers and things. So I was quite lucky. I mean, I thought it was something. Anybody, we play a piano here? I don't know. And there wasn't a piano moved, so there wasn't somebody to play the piano. Anyway, I most nights I was, in fact, maybe every night. In the boat. But coming through the Indian Ocean, it was so warm and hot, we could sleep up on the deck. Up and top. We were three deep down below. You couldn't all get up at the same time. And, I mean, there was only about 2 feet between your head and the next pipe or something. If you sat up quickly, you'd bang your head in the pipe. But, and the food in the boat was pretty awful. I remember saying, I go, look at this stuff, and I got my little dish thing. I said, that's the wettest looking tatties that I've ever seen. He says, that's not tatties, that's cabbage. He said, so I couldn't tell there's between cabbage and tatties. Was that kind of food?
So they needed potter there.
Can
you remember the name of the boat?
Danera, I think it was. HMS Danera. I remember I saw many years later in Scrapyard at Leith, down at the, you know where you cross the Forth Bridge, it's in Arlethan, is it down there or somewhere? No, it's not in Arlethan, it's Inverkeithing. There's a big scrap boat being scrapped there, and I saw the Danera was in there, that's a long time ago. But coming home, we had like a glass until we got into the Mediterranean in a horrendous storm. I mean, she came up so far out of the water, the screw at the back came out, and she used to wobble and vibrate it until she got back into the water again. And we were sitting at the table, and there was a sauce bottle, HP sauce bottle, I think, that slid up the table, and then it slid back down again the table. It slid back the table, and there were only about three of us sitting at the table. We were all sitting, I wasn't sick, and neither were the other two. Most folk were sort of puking over the side or in the loo or somewhere. That Bell Black, the chap that I was with, and he was green for about 2 days. Well, this bottle went up the table, and it went right off the end of the table. It opened the day, and nobody thought of putting their hand out to stop it. It was very, very rough. I mean, I remember going out on the deck and I was looking up at water. The waves were so high. And there was tankers that you could see looking over the side, and they were just going straight through the wave. The wave just broke over the front of the tanker, around the wheelhouse and past. The boat never went up and down at all. It just went, it was almost like a submarine. It just went straight through. Our boat went up and down like a cork. It was really going up and down.
And was that a large ship? Was there many?
It was 12,000 tons, I think. I can't remember. There was a few hundred men on it anyway. But there was mussels and there was dancers at night. It was a very cheery affair. And coming through the Indian Ocean, you could see the flying fish. You know, they were sort of skipping across at night. They seemed to be fluorescent at night. It was warm, but the Mediterranean was rough.
Can you remember any of the music that you played?
No. I didn't. I just can't tell. I mean, there was other guys playing, and I just kept in tune with them. It's enough to get me off carrying beer up on the hold there.
And you mentioned, was it the bunks in that accommodation?
Yes, bunks.
Would have been many men in the same room as yourself?
Oh, heavens, it was packed then. It was like an egg box. I mean, there were a narrow passage and three bunks at either side all the way up. I can't remember how far along, but you'd certainly squeeze in. It was, I don't think it would have been possible for all of us to stand up to get rid of our beds at the same time. We could all lie down like we were three deep. If we all had stood up together, you were really standing. You put your clothes on your bed with a height of 2 feet, you know, wall your sway like this.
And what about, they had the showers and everything on
there? Yeah, they did.
And did you stop at any ports of call?
We stopped at in Salop, and we stopped at Port Said, I think it was.
Were you allowed off the ship?
Well, it was off. It was just off and on again. It wasn't. I can't remember ever having any sightseeing too or anything like that.
And so, do you remember where you landed?
Must have landed about Southampton, I think. I can't honestly remember that, but it must have been okay if it came up in a train from there.
Did you have to go back to the Gordon Barracks then?
No, went to Keith. I think it would have been the Desert Fowler Army Depot up at Keith. And we spent one night in a Nissan hut. That's when I heard nothing. It was fascinated by hearing. It was either in a train or before or on a boat, you know, it was always a noise of some sort. And all of the actually ability itself, but it was always a noise. The first total silence that I'd heard for a year and a half.
And was this Nissen Hut up at Keith?
Mm-hmm.
And what like was the accommodation there? Was it bunks or?
Oh, no, it was beds. And I think there might have been about maybe 10 of us in the same Nissen Hut. But it was only there for one night.
And then what happened?
And then I was told he can go home, I think. Uh-huh. It was kind of a non-event, if you know what I mean. It was the end of it. And then after that, I remember got my call-up stuff and there's reserve sailors stuff. And I remember thinking, I went to one of these training camps and they were using stuff that was obsolete. I mean, we had been far ahead of that stuff. And I did think it was a terrible waste of time me going to that. And I remember writing to Boothby, who was our MP, and I said, this is a nonsense. They've got a letter back, look, it's a lot less hassle, just go and do it, that'll be the end of it. And that's where I went to Scarborough by that time when I was in an army camp there. But I didn't have to do anything, because again I got stuck on a vehicle. And they must have known that I could, because I had been a driver. And that's why I was out at night with the MPs, picking up these guys that fell by the wayside of it.
And do you think you handed back all your kit at Keith?
I think we must have done.
And then you just came home?
Uh-huh.
And when did you get the, when did you get the call-up papers in this reserve camp as well?
Oh, not long after. It was, within a year, we had to go and do a Z-reserve training camp, I think, a Z-reserve training thing.
Would this have been something to do with, a Suez crisis?
No, I think just to keep our hand in, I think, I suppose, or something like that. But I did think it was a hell of a waste. But as the MP time said, it was easier just you to go.
And how long were you away for?
I think about 10 days or something like that.
And were you issued with new kit and everything again?
Well, must have done. Mm-hmm.
And then with was that the call-up papers or was that the reserve?
No, it was a Z-reserve thing that I was speaking about. Uh-huh. But I remember going into I had a little PR2 sports car. And I remember driving into the Gordon Barracks in Aberdeen. And the guy in the car giving me a tremendous salute. But I never told them I was just a private.
And did you have occasions to go back to the Gordon Barracks, after you came out of the Gordons?
No, I really didn't have very much to do again with the army until the museum got started, and I thought it right that we should keep some tradition, sort of some of the history of the thing going, and that's when I became a bit more involved again with the thing. Peter Graham, of course, I knew him anyway, so it was. I suppose a combination of things. Anyway, I mean, I go to the museum quite a bit now. I go coffee there and I go to most of the functions that they have, or some of the functions there anyway, that they've got. And a car turning up at the end of the road here, I could see.
And when roughly did the museum start up, or when did you get involved in it? I believe there was a museum at the Gordon Barracks anyway, was that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it was amazing, though. We were just National Service. We were very proud of the battle honours that was in display in the Gordon Barracks in Aberdeen. I mean, we looked at it in sort of our imaginations, sort of, when we had Finnatar get in the VC and that dark guy and these sort of Afghanistan type things. That, having had a little bit of army life, you could kind of imagine what it must have been like for these guys there.
Were you allowed into the museum at the barracks when you were in National Service, or was it by invitation only?
No, I think we were taken in. and shown the things. It was very much trying to build up some pride in ourselves and in the regiment. Although we were only there for national service, and I think most of us felt that pride. I was aware of who the people who had gone before us, as it were. Oh yeah, I think so. I think we were taking that.
So you did feel that pride in the Gordon?
Oh yes, definitely.
And when they started up the new museum at St Luke's, were you involved with that as well?
When they started up the museum? The fundraising thing, I bet, yes, I was.
And apart from the fundraising, you know, when it first moved to St Luke's up at Viewfield, were you involved with it in any way then?
No, just I went to support all the functions that were there. Sometimes took other people with me. So, I mean, that was a little bit of whatever you call fundraising that I would have done, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And what about when you actually came out, your national service as well? I believe that you went back to the farm, did you?
Mm-hmm. Well, my father died, you see, a year after I came out. And he was ill for that, most of that year.
Mm-hmm.
And it just grew from there. I mean, because
did it take some adjustment to go back to the farming lifestyle after?
Yes, but it came back to a more... before I left, I had been very much involved in the manual work and bits of the farm. After I came back, with my father being ill, I was more and more involved in the administration part of the thing, rather than the actual hands-on labouring work, if you know what I mean. But, I mean, all the jobs that was on the farm, I had done them all anyway. I mean, I knew what was required, and I knew what kind of effort was needed. So it was good in that aspect. Although, when I came back, father was... he was able to advise me very much so from the thing. And it was, I was going more into the management side of it rather than the working side, the labouring side of the thing. So in that aspect, I suppose that only helped a bit, yeah. I knew what it was like to be bugging about.
And did you miss the company of the other men or anything?
Sounds callous to say no, but I was never a loner. I had always a lot of people around me, as it were. And I contacted, there was two or three guys that I kept up for a bit. Went to see them, they came back to see me, as it were, sort of thing. But it was never, just I had gone a different way. You know, my interests and the people that I was meeting were involved with business people, and I, you know, sort of, some of them I became friendly with. And it was just going in a different direction. The contact that I had with the guys in the past was, well, I still see some of it yet, but I didn't make a big thing. I mean, I didn't join the British Legion, for instance. I don't know whether it was I felt I did enough or not, but it was, I just had my interest for elsewhere, you know what I mean.
But you've had a very busy and successful career since then.
Well, it's been quite busy, I mean, but it was a kind of thing that I didn't plan. It kind of just evolved, it just happened. And it just sort of grew that way.
Do you think your national service helped your future career?
I think I was invited to join things. I was asked to become a governor of the North of Scotland College. Now, I don't know whether my national service had any effect on that. How do you know what makes people do things? I don't expect it did me any harm. I was then invited to become a director of the Aberdeen Milk Company, and again, I think the fact that they would have known that I had been in the army probably didn't do me any harm, again. But who knows? It was just, as I said, my life has kind of evolved on its own, without me doing anything about it, as it were. Happily, quite nicely, too.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, well, I hope that's some use to you.
I'm sure it will.
I do feel I'm better than I ever was.